Bob Certain and his B-52 crew were shot down over Hanoi. We talk about his journey there and home again. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Tuesday, August 24th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we talk with former POW Bob Certain ahead of his debrief with the South Dakota program Old Guys and Their Airplanes. Ahead of that, we welcome SDPB's Ariel Zients for a look at a collaborative boost for Native American tourism. We also welcome author Samantha Specks. Her debut novel explores the hanging of the Dakota 38 in 1862. It's a fictional look at two young women whose lives intersect among the violence and injustice of the time. Plus, a new beginning for the Sioux Empire Community Theater that's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm Kyle Ireland. State regulators are acting on lessons learned from a failed natural gas project. They're requiring a higher bond from a company that wants to reuse the wells. SDPB's Seth Tupper reports.
A Wyoming company called Highwire Energy Partners wants to use 19 orphaned natural gas wells. The wells are in the northwest corner of the state near Buffalo. The company has to post a bond. The state can use the bond money if something goes wrong with the wells and the company is not financially able to plug them. A new state law says the minimum bond is $100,000. But the company is agreeing to post a $190,000 bond if it uses all 19 wells. Mike Lees is the administrator of the state's minerals and mining program. He says the state negotiated the amount with the company.
Well, this is voluntary on their behalf. This is above and beyond the normal $100,000 blanket bond.
The 19 wells are part of a broader 40-well project. A Texas company went broke not long after drilling the wells 15 years ago. State laws at the time only required $30,000 in bonds. That was not enough to plug the wells, so the state used taxpayer money. Lees says the state recently plugged more than half of the wells.
Plugging the 21 wells and reclaiming the compressor site cost the state approximately $301,000.
The plugging stopped when Highwire Energy Partners expressed interest in the remaining 19 wells. The company views the natural gas as a cheap power source for an unusual project. The gas will fire generators hooked to shacks full of computers. The computers will run 24 hours a day, solving complex numerical problems that bring new bitcoins into existence. Bitcoin is one of several digital currencies known as cryptocurrencies. I'm SDPB's Seth Tupper.
Gerritsen High School has its first female football player, and she's making a big first impression. SDPB's Megan Feary has more.
It was like a scene out of a movie. Junior Jenna Van Holland scored the game-winning point in overtime Friday against Vyborg Hurley.
I can't even explain how crazy it felt, honestly.
It was a night of firsts. Van Holland's first time playing football, and the first time the Gerritsen Blue Dragons have had a female player. But Van Holland doesn't think it's a huge deal.
The boys on the team, they're really supportive, and they take me in. It's not like there's a huge difference between us. I'm part of the team, and everybody's really supportive on the team. It really doesn't feel that different, honestly.
Until last Friday, Van Holland didn't think much about football. She's a soccer player. But the Blue Dragons needed a kicker. Coach Chris Long says the team's previous kicker graduated last year.
So we were walking by, and I said to the soccer coach, I said, hey, we don't got any kickers. Anybody out there for me? Kind of mostly tongue-in-cheek. I thought it'd be a ha-ha, sorry. And she says, actually, we do got a couple girls that can kick. So I said, seriously? And she says, yeah. And I said, if you guys want to try it, I'm coming back down in about 50 minutes.
Long says a few soccer players tried out, but Jenna was the most consistent. Long says he was just happy to have a kicker. He never imagined the outcome.
If you literally said, what could be the most poetic story of a young female deciding to kick for a football team, the very first game she's ever played in, I mean, to kick the game-winning field goal and be rushed on the field because there's no time left, that's what happened.
Long doesn't know what this season will bring, but he's excited.
It really brought our kids together. I mean, the boys and the girls are getting along, and they support each other, and the culture right now is pretty cool.
The Gerritsen Blue Dragons play the Hanson Beavers this Saturday at home. I'm SDPB's Megan Feary.
With SDPB News, I'm Kyle Ireland.
And I'm Lori Walsh. The Pfizer vaccine has been granted full approval by the FDA, moving beyond the emergency use authorization status. Does that open the door for more vaccine mandates? How soon before a COVID vaccine is available for children under the age of 12? Dr. Shankar Kura is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health, and he's joining us now with a COVID in South Dakota update. Dr. Kura, welcome back.
Welcome. Thank you.
Let's start with our numbers, because they are once again climbing. 785 new total COVID cases today. 141 people in the hospital. That is not good. Those are tough numbers to take in.
Yes, we anticipated this with the Delta variant, and this rise in cases is going to continue, and probably through fall, and hopefully we will see a decline closer to end of fall.
Are we going to be in the same spot that we were last year, or are vaccinations going to help us through that, help us understand, surge capacity for beds? Is that already happening at Monument Health?
Yeah, we're kind of seeing a similar situation as the past. And, anytime you have a rising number of cases, it's going to put a strain on the health system. And we're seeing that here. We're seeing that everywhere, actually. Most big health systems are basically having to say we are full. And that's what we are seeing as well.
The Delta variant, more contagious, and we know a little bit more about that, about the R-naught. Explain R-naught again and what we know about how easily this Delta variant spreads and how many people can be affected by one sick person.
Yes, R-naught is the reproduction number. So in the world of viruses, the largest R-naught belongs to measles. So, you can get one person having measles can spread it to 18 others. In the alpha variant, or the original variant that we saw in the early days of this pandemic, it was two people. One person could spread it to two, maybe two and a half. The delta is twice that. So we're looking anywhere from five to six people getting the disease from one person. So that's why you're seeing a steep rise. When it's fast spreading, it's like an inverted V. You'll have a rapid rise and then a rapid decline.
Is it more deadly than the alpha variant? Is it more dangerous than the alpha variant?
As far as we know, it is not. If there is a difference, it's very minor at this time, but time will tell.
All right. How safe are vaccinated people? If you've already received your vaccines, how does the Delta variant impact you?
Excellent question. So this is the one I want everyone to take home. The vaccines are very effective, and you'll hear all these breakthrough numbers and all that. The focus should be on what the vaccines were designed to deliver. They were designed to prevent severe illness, hospitalizations, and deaths. So 98% risk reduction if you are vaccinated against hospitalizations, against deaths. So that has not changed. What has changed is that because it's highly transmissible, we're seeing some of what we call breakthrough infections. So vaccinated folks getting infected. But the good news is if you look at the data across the country, those that are hospitalized are almost 99% unvaccinated. The less than 1% that are vaccinated and fall ill enough to be in the hospital have other underlying conditions. So the takeaway is vaccines are working, one. Two, please get the vaccine, because it's the only way to stop this pandemic and stop the surge and the strain it puts on the health system.
Full approval for a vaccine means what? We've been operating under emergency use authorization status from the FDA. Now we're moving to the next step with the Pfizer vaccine. It's fully approved. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, and people misunderstand that. So when you use emergency use authorization, the data is strong for safety and efficacy. What's different when you authorize and approve, they have gone through the manufacturing process, the various steps, and ensure that every dose is exactly what it is designed to deliver. And that's what full approval means. So it just means that now this can be marketed. So it's more a step in the process, but it doesn't change anything as far as vaccine's efficacy. So I expect the other vaccine, Moderna, to receive full approval as well.
Okay, it doesn't mean that your kids under the age of 12 can receive the vaccine. We've heard a lot of misunderstandings about that. Clear that up for us, please.
Correct, yeah. The age limit is still the same, 12 and above, but we can see that changing as well by the end of this coming month. We expect approval for 5 and above for all for the vaccines.
Interesting. Marketing. What is the potential power of an organization like Pfizer being able to market directly to consumers? Does that change anything as far as getting the word out about the vaccine?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a game changer. What is always remains to be seen is that at least a good third of the population unwilling or still skeptical about the efficacy of the vaccine. And that's the message that's hardest to translate. The fact that these vaccines are the only solution out of this disease, and they work. They work very well.
You have talked to people who are still skeptical or still hesitant or still have chosen not to. Why? What are they saying? Like, at this point, what will change anything? For the people, here's what I'm getting at. The people who are vaccinated are getting frustrated with the people who are not. And the people who are not vaccinated are getting frustrated with being judged by the people who are. And it's more division. What changes that game? What actually works to convince somebody that they could make a different choice?
Yeah, it's very different, different for different people. I think the real matter that people have a hard time grasping is this is a true pandemic, once in a 100-year public health crisis. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times you can see these false equivalency of how this is just another flu or something simple like that. The reality is every single country in the world has been brought to its knees economically, socially, politically, and we're not going to get away from this until we get vaccinated. So I think the important thing is people have to recognize that this is a real public health crisis. And the one thing that's lost in the shuffle, and right now we're seeing it again with the surge, is folks that are not COVID disease, who really need care, are actually being sacrificed as a result, because they come to the hospital, which is full already, and either get the care or delay their care. And this is kind of sad.
Mm. We are still in that spot. Vaccines are available. They're accessible. They're free. And so get your vaccine, call your doctor, stop by your pharmacy, look around your community. It's kind of everywhere right now, right, Dr. Kaur?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Dr. Shankar Kaur, Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lori.
Up next, a collaborative boost for Native American tourism. SDPB's Ariel Zients has that story. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
Extreme fatigue. These are just a few of the dozens of sometimes debilitating symptoms associated with long COVID.
The big surprise was that a greater number of people who were never hospitalized were still having persistent symptoms.
Scientists are still trying to figure out what's driving long COVID. More on that research this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting this year's One Book South Dakota, The Children's Blizzard by Melanie Benjamin. Learn more about her virtual author tour and in-person Festival of Books appearance at sdhumanities.org.
Over the past year or so, we've learned to expect the unexpected. Stories change, news breaks, and then breaks again. We'll be feeling the changes for years to come and in ways we can't yet imagine. NPR is here to keep you connected and informed, to be a vital resource in a changing world. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB.
Program funding by the Museum and the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center and Pier. Now offering free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. Learn more by calling the Cultural Heritage Center or visit history.sd.gov.
Business and community development reporting on SDPB is supported by SDN Communications. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Tourism is South Dakota's second largest industry. Last year, nearly 13 million visitors spent nearly $3.5 billion while supporting 50,000 jobs. But Native American-operated tourism is underdeveloped, and there isn't much awareness about the experiences that do exist. The South Dakota Native American Tourism Alliance wants to change that. SDPB's Ariel Zients has more about this new group, which is celebrating a launch party on Tuesday. Ariel, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Ariel is joining us today from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Ariel, tell me, what exactly is the South Dakota Native Tourism Alliance?
So it stems all the way back to a 2015 federal law meant to promote Native American tourism. And it's important to know what that means. This is not just tourism about Native Americans, but tourism operated by Native Americans who then end up benefiting from this tourism. Mm-hmm. So then this Tourism Studies Department at George Washington University in D.C. partnered with the Bureau of Indian Affairs to develop this kind of tourism in North and South Dakota. The South Dakota group, it's an ad hoc committee. They've been meeting for the past year and a half, and now they're ready to publicize their five-year plan. Do Bad Warrior Ganji, she's a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, and she's a consultant helping GW with the alliance. She's also the VP, the vice president of the Black Hills Powwow. She did a really good job summarizing the purpose and the goals of this alliance.
I think the South Dakota Native Tourism Alliance is a potential revenue source for our tribes, and it's a way for our tribes to generate income, alleviate poverty, and help us to conserve our natural resources and culture.
And something that Du and others I spoke with emphasized is that this cultural and ecotourism, it has to be respectful and on the terms of each individual tribe, just to prevent things like exploitation or tourists inappropriately participating or barging into private ceremonies and places.
Right. All right. So what kind of ideas has the group come up with so far?
So one that multiple people emphasized is this: using already existing scenic drives that connect multiple tribes. And the group brainstormed existing and potential attractions along these routes. Seleni Mattis is the director of the Tourism Institute at George Washington University, and she explains the thinking behind this.
The idea is really that the tribal nations are working together to attract tourists and not going at it alone, ensuring that there is this cross-cultural bridge occurring and the education occurring through tourism along these trails and byways.
So these routes, these existing scenic routes, they help the tourist, you know, navigate mm-hmm. and see multiple things, but they also... it's the philosophy behind this, which is that the tribes are uniting together and helping each other.
Right.
And I want to tell you about one existing tourism business, which is Tatanka Res Tours. It's run by Gus and Tiana Yellowhair. They're a father-daughter pair, and they're Northern Cheyenne and Ogallala Lakota, and they've been doing tours of the Pine Ridge Reservation and the Black Hills for the past 7 years, and they've been attending meetings as part of the alliance. And here's Gus talking about how tourism can make a difference, and also an idea he came up with.
You know, the economic situation on the reservation is like almost 60 to 70% unemployment. And so we have big dreams and big ideas of being able to help the tribe with that portion of it by training young people in areas of tourism, in areas of art, possibly working, you know, with the state or with the government on, you know, opening up a facility on federal land. You know, we're going to approach them with that. And I think it's only fair that we get a piece of the pie.
So something that Gus and Tiana emphasized is like that this is a snowball effect. So mm-hmm. by them having this tourism company, they can employ people. They can bring people to visit elders who are sharing their culture. And those elders might be needing to train other people to learn language and cultural practices.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it's all about location, that federal partnership in the Black Hills. That's an important component to that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So what he means by that, and we do not see a lot of this in South Dakota. There is in the South Unit of the Badlands a formal partnership, but it's just such a remote and not frequently visited area. But what he's talking about is that he wants to open a tourism center or base in the Black Hills, whether it's the Black Hills National Forest or Custer State Park, since that was promised to the Lakota people, and now it's a very profitable tourism area, but mostly for non-Native people.
Right.
And this exists in other places. A really good example is at the Custer's Last Stand or the Battle of Greasy Grass site in Montana. The Crow Nation has a partnership there. And so, like, I went there, I showed up, I had no idea this existed, and I went on this wonderful tour by a member of the Crow Nation whose ancestors were part of that battle. Hmm. Another example, sometimes it's not as formal as that, sometimes it's just offering space. So if you drive from Sedona to Flagstaff in Arizona, there's this beautiful scenic overlook where multiple tribal members from multiple tribes just have an art market. So when tourists stop to look at the overlook, they can also make some money and share about their culture.
Right. All right, what's next for the Tourism Alliance, Ariel?
So they're having a launch, and I meant to say it's this Thursday in sure. Rapid City. They're launching the alliance formally and also a website. There's going to be state, federal, tribal leaders. They'll be presenting on this five-year plan, and then you'll hear from speakers like the owners of Tatanka Res Tours. There's going to be Lakota cuisine, a drumming group. And then afterwards, they're doing a tour of the Journey Museum here, downtown Native-owned businesses, and even foraging in the Black Hills.
Sure.
Yes.
Ariel Zions is SDPB's business and community development reporter. Ariel, thanks so much for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Ahead on the program, a high school student happens upon the Dakota 38 Memorial Ride in progress. Years later, that spark becomes a novel of two intersecting teenagers. We talk with author Samantha Specks. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
On the next Fresh Air, a dark side of the Navy SEALs. We talk with David Phillips, whose new book is about Eddie Gallagher, the SEAL who led his platoon in driving ISIS out of Mosul, was later tried for war crimes and granted clemency by President Trump. It's also about the SEALs who turned Gallagher in. Phillips covers the military for the New York Times. I hope you'll join us.
This afternoon at 2, One Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Before First Dakota filed its charter in 1872, there wasn't a bank in South Dakota. What will be your South Dakota first? FirstDakota.com/first.
We're proud to bring our community musical exploration every day here on SDPB. I'm Matt Wiesner, the host of On Record, our Saturday night show featuring Americana, roots, and blues music, mostly. You'll hear some old favorites and learn about new singer-songwriters on the scene. Every Saturday night at 10 Central, 9 Mountain, On Record, here on statewide SDPB Radio.
Some days we don't hear the big news until someone tells us. NPR keeps you connected to the world so you find out first. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this member station by name.
Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Author Samantha Specks is with us now. Her debut novel is called Dovetails in Tall Grass. It's the story of two young women, one is a Dakota Sioux woman, the other a white settler, whose lives intersect in 1862 during battles between the U.S. and the Dakota in what is now southern Minnesota. The spark for Dovetails in Tall Grass began years ago when the author happened upon part of the Dakota 38 Memorial Ride near Mankato. Samantha Specks joins us now on the phone to talk about her book. Samantha, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Lori. It's great to be here.
We're going to talk a lot about this really difficult history, but as I hold Dovetails in Tall Grass in my hand, I'm curious how it feels to unpack that book box and see all the work and all the people who supported you in this work, from the scholars and the archivists to the story keepers. And then you get to hold it in your hand. It's beautifully designed. Tell me about that moment for you as an author.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a little bit surreal having the book be out in the world now. I had a baby in the past year during the pandemic, and now I would liken having my book come out. I would say it feels like I'm both having a baby and sending my child off to college on the very same day. Oh, here, and I have to let it go.
That's a lot of emotion at once. How are you doing?
Yeah, it is. It's exciting, though. It's good. Yeah. It's a labor of love, and I'm proud of it, and I'm hopeful it'll do good things in the world.
All right. Take us back to when you were a high school student, and you're riding in your parents' car, and you look over, and you see these people on horseback, and you wonder, what exactly is going on there?
Yeah, so I was riding to my grandparents' house on Christmas Eve, and I was all cozy, going to, like, our annual family Christmas tradition, and we looked out the window on the cold prairie on the dark winter night, which I'm sure many of your listeners know well in South Dakota what that time of day and time of year feels like. And there was these men out riding in the cold on horseback. And I just remember thinking, wow, what is this group doing? And just the effort they were going through and what their experience was to cross those miles on the prairie just immediately struck me that whatever they were doing must be so important. And then when I later found out and educated myself that they were riding in memoriam of the U.S.-Dakota War of 1862, which resulted in the largest mass execution in United States history of 38 Dakota Sioux men. I was so impacted, and it forever changed the course of my life to see them riding from South Dakota. And then the more I learned about that time in history and this war, which, like I just said, resulted in the largest mass execution on one side, and then on the other side of the war was the largest civilian mass casualty event in United States history until the events of September 11th, kind of on the settler side of the war. So it's just this extraordinary pain and of what happened on this prairie, and it meant so much to me. And I just began to understand that history through the perspective of young women and thinking, what are the women's stories in all of this, and where, what would they be feeling and experiencing? And over the course of many years of research and writing, those lenses are now Emma and Onakika, and the story plays out on the page in Dovetails and Tall Grass.
So you have a big responsibility because you're going to write in the voice of a Dakota woman, and that is not a space that's not a lived experience that you have. Not that you have a lived experience of 1862, but there's an additional layer here. How did you address that responsibility by inviting the input of others?
For sure. It felt like a big responsibility to write from the lens of a different culture, and especially a Native culture that's so very different than the society that you and I live and participate in today. And I struggled with if I even should write from the Dakota Sioux perspective. Just felt so scared of doing any harm. I know there's been a lot of pain in this history, and that's the last thing I wanted. But then when I was thinking about writing the story from just the white settler perspective, I was like, no, the Native piece is so critically important, and to have it missing in another story felt even more problematic. So I researched and I spent a lot of time trying to dive into authentic Dakota Sioux sources and consulted with Dakota Sioux history keepers and some of the research librarians at different tribes in Minnesota, and worked with them. And then I also, after my first draft, I worked with a Dakota Sioux writer, Diane Wilson, who's phenomenal. And she gave me cultural feedback on the manuscript and some of those cultural components. And I'm really hopeful that I got either perspective right, but especially the Native one would be my greatest hope of all.
And give me an example of something that you learned through that process, even if this book didn't exist. The process of you putting your words in front of another writer with a different perspective, of them saying, you know, culturally, this is, you're off here, or this is something that resonates. What did you learn from that process?
Yeah, I guess one of the things that struck me was Diane was reminding me how some of these leaders in the Dakota Sioux community that would have been chiefs or like, for example, Little Crow, he still has descendants today, and being mindful to incorporate, I think I incorporated a lot of the actual history, but there were certain pieces that she was encouraging me to be mindful of his legacy as it lived on today and to think of it as a very living thing. And so there was a few pieces where I just added a little more of the actual history to color that in and make sure I was honoring certain legacies as much as I could in my writing.
Did you have to do, or then did you rethink how you told the story of Emma Heard, even though, you know, as far as thinking about the people who live in this area from the white European background and that culture continues on? Like, did I guess what I'm asking you is, did the way that you rethought one culture turn around and make you rethink your own?
Yeah, there were certain things with that. Then I was wondering, am I doing enough to still honor the legacy of certain people? And I think I did portray what mattered was some of the what I would call innocent settlers that were killed and the women and children. I think I highlighted some of their stories. But as far as some of the leadership in the U.S. Army, that was problematic. I feel like I held them accountable in the writing and didn't rewrite that in any way. I hope I hit on that responsibly as well.
Yeah. Tell listeners about Emma Heard. Let's start with her.
Yeah, so Emma Heard is my settler protagonist, and she is growing up in the town of New Ulm. Her father is a part-time country lawyer, and her family farmstead is attacked by Dakota Sioux warriors, and she has to take cover in town and survive the battles and wars, and ultimately participates as on the war trials that happened after, which would have been historically accurate, and kind of what she witnesses and what her responsibilities become. She has a pivotal role in the story and in the course of history, which ties into actual events that happened, but I won't give too much away
right?
with that.
It's always a challenge with fiction. It's like, what can we tell? So set the stage for Onikika. Am I saying her name correctly?
Yeah, Onikika. Yes. Yeah, so that's my Dakota Sioux protagonist. And she is the daughter of Chief Little Crow. And her calling is to be a healer and use the plants. But her family and her tribe is moved onto a reservation for the first time because of a deal that her father did with the president at the time, which is historically accurate as well. And then when the president and the U.S. Congress fails to come through on their end of the deal and the treaties, and they face starvation, her father is faced with some very difficult choices, and therefore she has to make some very difficult choices of her own at his side. That's about as much as I can give away for her.
This is not giving away anything to say that the weather has to be a character in this book.
Yes.
It's cold. And sometimes writers struggle to find different ways to say it is cold. How did you kind of get yourself in the space where in a novel about character, about history, about injustice, about guilt or shame, about place, you also have this sort of quintessential Minnesotan or, you know, plains area, chilling, biting, dangerous cold. Tell me a little bit about how you got yourself into that place to write about that.
Yeah, well, it sure helps to live here and know how it feels. You know the intensity of what it feels like, and I would often use weather and seasons as a metaphor or to reflect the emotions that each character was going through and the elements of what these people, each group of people faced as they tried to survive on the prairie. And I truly love Minnesota. And I wrote most of this while I was in Texas. And I make the drive from Texas to Minnesota a few times a year now. And I just love this part of the country. And I know some people call it the flyover states, but it's truly my favorite place. And I think it's so beautiful. And so I hope that got into the story as well.
Yeah. How did this change you then? You know, because it's your debut novel, you're working on the next novel. Did it help you kind of? Because this is also a story, without giving too much away, where people are finding their voices and you're finding your voice as a first-time author. How did that shift how you thought about your own voice, spending time with these characters?
Yeah, I know. It is a really powerful experience, and I definitely paralleled my own characters in their life, and it's kind of a leap of faith and an act of bravery to put myself out there in this story and the way each woman did and their own choices in the history. And I think it's something we all choose in our own way every day, is kind of how to live out loud and make those choices that are authentic to ourselves and living in our truth. And you kind of learn through the growing pains of it and through your failures and also through your success. And I think the more we each do that, we also find connection with others. And that's the powerful thing. And I think that's the most moving thing about the human experience is as we all figure this out together and kind of how we can grow through it.
We have been talking with author Samantha Specs. Her debut novel, Dovetails in Tall Grass, is available now. We'll put links up on our website after the show, but you can also find more information about the author at SamanthaSpecs.com. Samantha, nice meeting you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Lori.
Let's take a moment now for some South Dakota history. This week in 1923, U.S. Senator Thomas Sterling of South Dakota introduced legislation to prevent the willful obstruction of trains in interstate commerce. Sterling served in the Senate from South Dakota from 1913 to 1925. He was considered a statesman and senator well-versed in parliamentary process and deeply invested in lower-profile technical legislation, like the Train Interstate Commerce Act. He served on the Senate Committee on Civil Service and the Committee on Post Office and Post Roads. Perhaps more South Dakotans are familiar with Sterling in his role as the first dean of the USD Law School, but he was also involved in many early statehood activities. He was a member of the State Constitutional Convention in 1889, was in the State Senate in 1890, and after 10 years as the dean of the USD Law School, he served two terms in the U.S. Senate. After his Senate years, Sterling was appointed by President Calvin Coolidge as field secretary of the Commission for the Celebration of the 200th Anniversary of the Birth of George Washington. His most notable Senate achievement was establishing a retirement annuity for civil service employees and service on the Overman Committee, investigating seditious German and Bolshevik activities during World War I. But this week, in 1923, Senator Sterling introduced a bill making it easier to keep rail lines open for interstate commerce. Production thanks for this week in South Dakota history goes to Dr. Brad Tennant, professor of history at Presentation College. Ahead on In the Moment, a journey of one American military man surviving a POW camp. We'll talk with Colonel Bob Certain after the break. You're in listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge is arguably the best marathoner to ever live, the only person to run 26.2 miles in less than 2 hours.
I ran because I love the sport. Running is what actually has made me to enjoy life. You know, I always say where freedom is only in running.
A runner and his philosophy next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by Medco. Investing in your hometown to bring an expanded fiber network and next-gen tech to your door. Fiber is the future, and at Medco, the future is already underway. Medco.com/fiberforward.
Walk out the door and your world changes. Dark to light, quiet to noise. The stars, the sounds of insects and birds, kids playing, waves crashing, cars passing. Even in our most peaceful moments, the world is always moving, changing. Something big is happening somewhere. Take NPR with you and stay connected to the world outside your door. Listen live on your phone, at this station's website, or npr.org.
Listen at sdpb.org or download our app.
Issues and policies in our democratic process and how they impact our lives in South Dakota are highlighted on the SDPB Politics and Public Policy Beat, supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. On December 18, 1972, United States Air Force Navigator Bob Certain and his B-52 bomber crew were shot down over Hanoi during the Vietnam War. Certain spent 100 days as a POW. Well, this Saturday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, you can tune in for a conversation between Bob Certain and John Mollison. It's a special Old Guys and Their Airplanes debrief called Unchained Eagle. That's also the title of Bob Certain's memoir, in which he writes about his experience as a prisoner of war and his life after the war as an Episcopal priest. Bob, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let's go over some numbers, because when we say 100 days as a POW, this is a very truth is stranger than fiction kind of convergence. This is your 100th mission. You will get shot down right over. I'll let you tell it.
Yes, I was on, actually, the truth was stranger than anything on this one.
Yeah.
December the 18th was our scheduled return home date. And so those return home orders got canceled because of the beginning of what was called Linebacker 2. Mm-hmm. It was my personal 100th mission. We were shot down by two surface-to-air missiles within 10 seconds of our bombing target. So we had to eject rather quickly as soon as we assessed the damage and saw that the airplane was no longer flyable because it was on fire. And two crew members were dead or dying. So I ejected at the bomb release point, the number 19 airplane to drop bombs at that point with eight more behind me. So it was a little bit nerve-wracking, you might say.
At 13:13 Greenwich Mean Time, too. I mean, let's be clear.
13 Greenwich Mean Time.
And before, and I'm bringing these things out because not only is it interesting, but it's going to take us to a place where later on, you know, so much is lining up. There's an earth tremor before you take off. There's all these things that you will remember years later of the 100th mission, 100 days as a POW, 13:13 Greenwich Mean Time. You're signaling to the bombardier to drop the bombs seconds before you eject and are watching the bombs fall over the target. That is going to come back and be part of a story that you will have to unpack later in some unexpected ways. But let's take listeners back to that moment. You are in your parachute, very close to the drop zone, which is a rail yard, and other bombers are coming. How can you steer those things? Can you steer a parachute very well? No.
Not
that
well.
Kind.
Not
yeah. No.
Those were the old round military parachutes, similar to what was used in by paratroopers in World War II.
Yeah.
So to stabilize the chute, there's a daisy chain cord on the riser. You pull that, and it releases four of the risers on one side to create a spillway to stabilize the chute from swinging back and forth. Hmm. And then to steer it, you grab all the risers on one side and pull them down to your ankle and tilt the chute. And so once you tilt the chute, then it moves sideways. And fortunately, about 10,000 feet, the wind shifted and started blowing me off to the west and away from the target.
Mm. So you land relatively safely. You don't have major injuries, but immediately are spotted by villagers who will pelt you with rocks and tie you up and strip off your flight suit. And you are on your way to the Hanoi Hilton. Tell me some of the challenges that you have, because you're like 24 at this point?
I was 2 weeks past my 25th birthday.
Wow.
So I just turned 25. The challenges were that, first of all, I had nothing except my underwear. Mm-hmm. And I was surrounded by enemy civilians. There were four militia with AK-47s. In the crowd, basically protected me from the civilians. Mm-hmm. I was roped and blindfolded, and then I had to walk along the railroad track on those rocks until we got to a path and a little road and into one village after another. At one point, I thought they were going to shoot me because it looked like a firing gallery that we passed. I could see under the bottom of my blindfold. And then I was up to a road, and we were down in the ditch, and one of my other crew members was across the culvert from where I was. I could hear his voice. But there was some bombing in the area, so we were down in the ditch till the bombing subsided. And then put into a truck and eventually taken across the Red River on a ferry and into Hanoi. Mm. And into what we call the Hanoi Hilton, the Hoa Lo prison. Yeah. And to be interrogated for the rest of the night and part of the next day. So there I was, no food, no drink, no relief, standing on concrete floor in my bare feet in winter, and being asked questions that I knew I had no intention of answering.
Right.
So all of my training about how to be a prisoner of war, which lasted 3 or 4 days a couple of years earlier, had to bring back up. And
quickly.
Really quick. I had to make a plan.
Under great duress.
Come up with a plan and stick with it. That's right.
You have a sense of defiance and rebellion and mischief as I watched your oral history, where you're kind of retelling some of the ways you divert the enemy. They're asking you about a quail, which refers to a missile. You had to say, well, no one had a quail. We had roast turkey or just kind of playing these games of mischief and deflection. Did you have a sense, but yet this is also terror. And I want to know if the sense of humor comes after, years later, or if at the time, kind of playing that, I'm not going to tell you what you want to hear, was also keeping you alive.
Well, a little bit of both. In survival school, where we were trained to live off the land and trained to defend ourselves if we were captured and interrogated, was to keep your story as simple as possible with the fewest details. So I tried to say, I'm sorry, I'm just a celestial navigator. I don't know anything about the question you're asking. And they kept saying, we know you know, and threatening to take me to a bombing site. And I thought, well, it's not going to happen. So in part, Americans can maintain their sense of humor in the worst of circumstances, and are always looking for a way to, if you can't physically escape, at least to escape the interrogation.
God,
and that's what I was trying to do.
My father was a Vietnam veteran, never captured, never POW, and he taught me that same stuff about sense of humor and mentally escaping and sticking to a simple story. Even if you were trying to lie, he'd be like, the truth is easier to remember a lot than a lie, so keep your lie simple.
That's right.
The wisdom.
Make it a truth is just not a complete truth.
I never associated that with his time in Vietnam, so that's an eye-opener for me. But I do want to go back briefly, and I'm just so glad John Mollison is going to have all this time with you. And I would also encourage people to find your oral history online, because there's just so much there to read your memoir. But what I was saying before about this earth, this earth tremor that happens, you realize years later that this is affecting you, because as things get closer to completion, what would it be the equivalent of a modern day mission, whether it's in business or in life or in family, that there's part of you that remembers that this is going to lead to something horrific. Tell me a little bit about, because you don't start unpacking that until 2001? It takes you years to figure out some of those connections.
It only took 30 years.
It only took 30
years. I've unpacked it a little piece at the time and always convinced myself I'd done all the unpacking.
Yeah.
And so, for instance, anniversary stories, I learned about anniversary stories about 10 years later and realized that some of the tensions I felt in ministry occurred between Christmas and Easter, but those were the same dates of my imprisonment. I was shot down a week before Christmas. I came home a week before Holy Week the next year. And so the tensions were old news. They were just there in the subconscious. Now then, later, as I continued to live my life and having some other kind of interesting experiences, I learned through a therapy called EMDR, eye movement desensitization redirection, that the themes of the past, or what affect your decision making in the present, and not necessarily the events of the past, which was a new learning for me.
That is revolutionary.
So for instance, the themes for me were that from that last mission where I was shot down were similar to the themes that occurred in a church when we did a capital stewardship drive to raise a few million dollars to build a new building, pay off debt, whatever. And it took me, it was almost 30 years home before that awareness was put together. And EMDR led me through telling the story of that final mission in great detail, stopping to say what, you know, the psychologist would say, what are you smelling?
Mm-hmm.
What are you seeing? What else could you have done? And what is your anxiety level? And so as we worked through all of those questions and that mission, about two months into it, so about 12 sessions, then the anxiety level, as I told the story, went way down. And my wife noticed kind of after four sessions that I was a different person. And some friends came to visit at Christmas and said, what happened to you? And so my personality apparently got rosier. I thought I was always rosy.
I'm inspired by hearing you talk about that, because I've heard of EMDR before, to do another segment on this program about that, especially for veterans who are struggling, you know, with the news from Afghanistan right now, and we'll continue to tell that story. Yeah. But you can hear a lot more from Bob Certain. You can read his book, Unchained Eagle. You can tune in to The Debrief with Colonel Certain this Saturday morning, and that's a conversation with John Mollison. We're going to put a link up on our website at sdpb.org/news in today's show notes. If you do want to go directly there, you can just log in to the Distinguished Flying Cross Society's webpage. That's dfcsociety.org on Saturday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain. There's going to be some watch parties as well at the South Dakota Air and Space Museum, at Ellsworth Air Force Base, and at the South Dakota Military Alliance in Sioux Falls. Colonel Certain, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Happy to share.
Up next, the Sioux Empire Community Theater in downtown Sioux Falls is set for another season, now under a new name, the Premier Playhouse. Robin Byrne is executive director, and he's joining us now inside the Kirby Family Studio. Welcome back, Robin.
Thank you, Laurie. Nice for you to invite me back again.
We're going to celebrate theater for a few minutes in a rather heavy time, and yet theater can address these heavy themes and also provide some escapism as well. Let's start with the new season, because I want to hear some of what you're bringing to audiences, and then we'll get into the name change for a couple minutes.
Okay. Well, we've got a 5-show season, and unusually for us, the first show isn't going to be at the Orpheum. It's going to be in the Belbus Theatre in the Washington Pavilion.
Nice.
It's a show called Blood Brothers. It's from the UK. It's set in Liverpool in the 1960s. And I've been wanting to do this show for a long time. I've got two daughters in England who travel all over the country whenever that show is on, just to see it again.
Yeah.
It was nominated for 6 Emmys. It won the Laurence Olivier Award for the Best Musical. And I've hidden lots of references to the Beatles in the show, in the set, in the action, and even in the dialogue. So anybody coming along will have to look for these hidden Easter eggs, if you like.
a little surprise. Why the Belbus then?
Well, simply because the Orpheum is so busy with bookings.
Okay.
We've got our normal 4 main stage shows, and we couldn't squeeze a 5th one into the Orpheum, so we thought we'd do it at the Belbus. So we moved back into the Orpheum for the remaining 4 shows of the season.
All right, let's talk about this name change, because this is the first time that you have had a season-long sponsor, but it's not necessarily the same. It's a little confusing. So where does the Premier Playhouse come from?
I'll clarify it. First of all, you've got the Playhouse. People still refer to us as the Playhouse, because the community theater before us was the Sioux Falls Community Playhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought it would be good to pay homage to those folks who went before us and paved the way. But we didn't just want to be called the Playhouse, so we kind of liked the word premiere with an E on the end. It's the theatrical definition of an opening night.
Yep.
And we want to be the best, playhouse in the area. And I think we are the best community playhouse or community serving theatre company and we need to keep improving to stay there. So having decided to do that, within a couple of days, I happened to be buying some cigars and ran into Dana Dykhouse in the cigar shop from from First Premier, and I had a chat with him and told him, you know, this would be a great partnership, you know? And he agreed, and they are now our season sponsors for the next four seasons.
All right. We're going to have you back, Robin, to talk more about this premiere season for the Premier Playhouse. We'll put some links up on our website as well. Congratulations. Welcome back, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
We close today's show by honoring someone we have lost. Melissa Hammersmith-Severs was a beloved colleague here at South Dakota Public Broadcasting. You probably know some of her signature work from SDPB television programs like Savor Dakota and Dakota Life. We heard her voice even when we didn't see her face. We looked through her camera lens and we saw South Dakota anew through her eyes. Well, Melissa died last week after battling lymphoma and West Nile virus. She leaves behind a loving husband, Nick, and two small children, Owen and Isaac. She was the kind of mother who taught her kids five-finger breathing to help them deal with tough emotions. She gardened. She foraged for mushrooms. She was warm and welcoming, even if she didn't know you. She was generous and genuine and really, really unexpectedly funny. She was kind in a way that makes kindness memorable and more kindness inevitable. Professionally, Melissa also leaves a legacy of unearthing stories by listening deeply to what people are passionate about. Here she is describing the genesis of some of those stories.
It's not uncommon for people to be humble. Like, sometimes they don't right. think that their story is really much to brag about. But I enjoy, you know, seeing what people get excited about. You know, a few years ago, I did a story about the state plowing competition. A group of folks from around the country gathered in a field outside of Beersford, South Dakota, and they were competitively turning over ground.
I can't think of a better metaphor for Melissa's storytelling abilities than the metaphor of her turning over South Dakota soil and looking closely at the beauty and complexities of our everyday lives as we push through hardships, wrap our roots around one another's, and stretch toward the prairie sunshine. Melissa Hammersmith-Severs, thank you for your voice and for your vision. And thank you for listening as we remember our friend.